From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Don Gagne. It's Here and Now. A Florida-based doctor has been arrested as a suspect in the assassination of Haitian President Jovenel Moïse, who was shot in the middle of the night in his home last week. There are now more than 20 suspects in police custody and still many unanswered questions about the president's killing and what the resulting political uncertainty means for Haiti. Jacqueline Charles joins us now by Skype from the Haitian capital, Port-au-Prince. She's Caribbean correspondent for the Miami Herald. Jacqueline, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us what we know so far about this doctor who's been arrested. His name is Christian Emmanuel Sanon. Tell us about him.
So according to Haiti's police chief in a press conference yesterday, this physician came into Haiti sometime in June. He came on a private plane. He is someone who has filed federal bankruptcy. He has more than $400,000 in debt. He's been a president in South Florida from the West Coast all the way down to the Palm Beach area for more than two decades. So on paper, when you look at his filings in the court documents, and he also claims to also be a pastor, it's just not adding up because, as I've been told by Haitian officials here, this was a multi-million dollar plot. So one of the things that they've done in claiming the connection to Sanon as the alleged mastermind is that he is the one who contracted with a company in the Miami area called CTU Security, Counter Terrorist Unit. This company is owned by a Venezuelan. The official story we got yesterday from Haiti's police chief is that this company was contracted by Dr. Sanon in order to provide security for his business, himself, and eventually him as president of Haiti. The two Haitian Americans that are in custody have said that they were hired as translators. The job was not to kill President Jovenel Moïse, but to go in, arrest him, take him to the palace where they would install a new president. According to my sources at the time, that president would have been Dr. Sanon.
What is the mechanism by which he would have been, could have actually become president and assumed power? He has been based in Florida for 20 years or so. How would that have worked?
That's still a mystery. I mean, in Haiti, you know, there's a law that says even if you're running for president, you have to have been a resident of this country for 5 years. There's also a law that says that you cannot arrest somebody after 6 p.m. at night unless it's in the commission of crime. So, again, you know, there are a lot of questions. Very few answers, because even if you were to say, quote unquote, arrest the president, who are you to say that you are going to be the one that should assume power or should replace him? So all of this is really not panning out, including the involvement of this doctor who on paper, you know, looks like a bankrupt physician, if that.
So the intricacies needed for a plot like this, at least so far, don't appear to have been in place.
Exactly. There are a lot of questions that people have, especially when you consider that this was happening at the president's private residence. He had presidential guards. Some of the hierarchy in that chain have basically been relieved of their leadership roles, and they have to check in with internal affairs on a daily basis, and some of them are being questioned today. How is it that individuals can come into the president's yard, much less in his house, in his bedroom, kill him, shoot him with 12 bullets, and then they couldn't find their way out of the area?
What more do we know about the people arrested and accused of carrying out the assassination, at least those arrested so far, including two Haitian Americans and a number of Colombians? Do they know that they were involved in what is alleged to be this larger plot that you've been describing?
The two Haitian Americans, when they spoke to a judge and they spoke to someone else that I questioned, they told them that the mission was not to kill President Jovenel Moïse. They were there as translators to arrest him. Yesterday, Haiti's police chief, who I will tell you has told me that he did not believe this story, he said that at some point the mission changed. And we're still trying to get more details in terms of what was the change, when did it happen, why did it happen.
What's going on now in the streets of Haiti? Obviously, a lot of political uncertainty. The government there has been in a state of dysfunction long before this assassination. What are people saying and thinking about the current situation?
Every day, there's a little bit more activity on the streets, but there are concerns, especially given the unanswered questions there are. We have an acting prime minister. We have another prime minister who is the prime minister designate, who was picked by President Jovenel Moïse just days before his death. And we now have the president of the Senate, who has basically been chosen by his colleagues to serve as interim president. So you've got three men here who are vying for leadership of this country, and things still very much remain uncertain.
Jacqueline Charles is Caribbean correspondent for the Miami Herald. Jacqueline, thank you.
Thank you.
The CDC's new COVID guidelines for schools are raising some questions. The rules say fully vaccinated students and teachers don't need to wear masks in school or to social distance. Some educators worry the recommendations will create a two-tier system. Another concern is that it can be difficult to figure out which kids have been vaccinated and which have not. Kristen Moffitt is an infectious disease specialist at Children's Hospital in Boston. Doctor, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So clearly the federal government is making a statement here with these guidelines that it wants schools to reopen for in-person learning in the fall. Are you on board with what you're hearing from the CDC?
I am largely on board with what we're hearing from the CDC. I think that these guidelines reflect what now is a growing body of data that continue to demonstrate how effective available vaccines are at preventing infection and at reducing the spread. And we know now that vaccinated individuals are much less likely both to become infected and to infect others. I think, secondly, this also reflects the CDC's understanding of how unbelievably detrimental remote learning scenarios were for children across America for the majority of the last school year.
So the CDC is saying that if you're vaccinated, you don't need to wear a mask. But kids under 12 that have not been vaccinated or cannot be vaccinated still do need to wear masks. The other issue is that it will ultimately be up to local government to decide what to do in schools. And every place is different. In Arizona, mask mandates are not allowed in schools. And in California, everyone will still be required to wear them. So how should we account for that?
I do worry particularly about how variable these recommendations may be followed, particularly in areas where vaccination rates are low. And we know now that these are the areas that are either currently seeing surges or are certainly at increased risk of experiencing surges. And that's especially true with the highly contagious Delta variant. So it will really fall upon families to assess what their risk is in their geographic area and to understand that continued precautions such as masks, especially worn indoors for unvaccinated individuals, including young children, are even more important in these areas, both for protection of those unvaccinated children, but also for continued control of spread of COVID-19 in those regions.
Do you expect in the fall, when school gets started again, to see more schools shut down because of outbreaks and go back to virtual learning?
That is a possible outcome, particularly in areas where vaccine coverage is very low. One thing we know is that children who are too young to be vaccinated still get indirect protection if the majority of the adults that they interact with on a day-to-day basis are vaccinated. And that's because there's just less virus circulating within their environment. So I do worry that in parts of the country where vaccine coverage amongst older children and amongst adults is very low, there is the increased risk of seeing schools needing to shut down.
And when do you think those younger kids under 12 will be eligible for the vaccine?
So we know that both Pfizer and Moderna are currently conducting studies in children ages 11 and under. Those studies are going to move more slowly than they did in the 12 to 17-year-olds. And part of that is because those studies need to start with dose-finding studies. Unlike the 12 and older group, who are receiving the same dose and the same schedule of mRNA vaccines that adults have received, lower doses are being trialed in younger children. And the anticipated timeline for vaccines to be available to children under the age of 12 is looking most like late 2021 to maybe early 2022.
So only a third of kids between the age of 12 and 17 who can be vaccinated have gotten the shot. So there's still a lot of ground to cover before school starts. Do you expect that number to rise significantly?
I hope that number rises significantly. I've been talking to a lot of families with children in that age range, some who have been reluctant to get their adolescents and teenagers vaccinated because they're waiting for more data. And I think it's safe to say now that the data are there. We have over 8.5 million people between the ages of 12 to 17 who've now been vaccinated. These vaccines still are demonstrating a very good safety profile. These vaccines are still very effective in this age range. So if families have been waiting for more safety data, more experience in this age range, I would say we're there.
Pediatric infectious disease Dr. Kristen Moffitt from Children's Hospital in Boston. Dr. Moffitt, thank you very much.
Good to be here.
Two statues of Confederate generals no longer stand in Charlottesville, Virginia. Some onlookers cheered as crews removed the statue of General Robert E. Lee on Saturday. Here's Charlottesville Mayor Nakia Walker, the first black woman to lead the city.
It has stood for 104 years, and it doesn't need to stay a moment longer.
Crews also removed a statue of General Stonewall Jackson from a different park. It's been nearly 4 years since the Charlottesville City Council first laid out a plan to take down the statues following a deadly rally by white supremacists there in 2017. Ben Pavior is a reporter for member station VPM. He joins us now for more. Hi, Ben.
Hi.
Why, after nearly 4 years, did the city decide to bring the statues down this weekend?
Well, the short answer on why it took so long is a legal battle. And shortly after City Council narrowly voted to take them down back in February of 2017, there was a lawsuit from a group that included the Sons of Confederate Veterans and some other groups. And the judges ordered the statues be kept in place until that was resolved. That legal battle finally ended in April with a ruling from the state Supreme Court that allowed them to take it down. And then that kind of set off this procedural process of around 60 days for the city council to review the plans. And they set aside money on Wednesday. And then you heard Mayor Walker there talking about why once they did that, they didn't want to linger. They wanted to get them down.
The city also took down a statue of explorers Meriwether Lewis and William Clark and Sacagawea. Was that a surprise?
Yes and no. So the council held a surprise meeting on Saturday after the first two statues came down where they unanimously agreed to move it that day. Work crews had already finished the work, and they figured they would save money by just using them to take down this other statue. But at the same time, this had been in the works for a while. They voted to take it down back in 2019 after consulting with some Native Americans. The statue is controversial because of the way it depicts Sacagawea. She's kind of crouching behind the two white men whom she traveled with on their journey west. And as I said, the city heard from Native Americans that found the statue very offensive. One descendant of the interpreter, Roseanne Abramson, told council on Saturday that she wanted to see it melted down and obliterated, although she was also open to using it as an educational tool. And that wasn't the only statue that tribal groups objected to. At the University of Virginia, officials took down a statue depicting George Rogers Clark, who's the brother of the explorer, and he was depicted attacking a group of American Indians. It's not clear what they're going to do with that statue or any of them, really.
For a lot of people, the Robert E. Lee statue isn't just connected to the painful legacy of the Confederacy, but to more recent history, the history of that white supremacist protest of a few years ago. Remind us how this statue became linked with that moment.
Well, I mean, this was 2017, so Donald Trump was the newly elected president, and you know, white nationalist groups were very enthusiastic about his win, and many of them seized on the removal of the statues or the plans to remove them as a kind of rallying cry. So in May, Richard Spencer, who was a white nationalist and UVA graduate, led a group of Tiki Torch supporters in a rally that ended at the statue. In June, there was a small KKK rally. And then in August, there was the deadly Unite the Right rally, which left three dead, including Heather Heyer, who was killed when a man affiliated with far-right groups drove through a crowd of counter-protesters. And you know, that day left deep scars in the city. It really shook up Charlottesville's identity of itself. I grew up there, and there was a deep pride when I was living there and being this kind of diverse, prosperous, liberal college town. And now, after the rally, Unite the Right, there were deep divisions on how to move forward. But I think, despite all that, there's a rare bit of consensus among city council and probably broadly among the public on the need to remove the statues.
You spoke to a high school student who started the petition that really began the push to remove the Robert E. Lee statue back in 2016. What did she share with you about the removal of that statue?
Zayana Bryant was really integral to starting this conversation back then and driving it since then. She's a student at UVA now and was at the takedowns. And I asked her what prompted her to act back then.
There's so many ways for people to learn about the South in a way that it doesn't have to be romanticized. It doesn't have to be a part of our public spaces in a way that makes people feel excluded.
And part of what she's responding to there is this idea that statues are a part of history, and to some people, taking them down is a kind of erasure. But it's important to remember the context in which they're erected. Long after the Civil War in the 1920s, there was segregation in full force, regular KKK meetings in towns, there were cross burnings. And so for others, I mean, that's the part of history that's been kind of erased.
We've got about 30 seconds left. Was there visible opposition to the removal of the statues on Saturday? And what have you heard from opponents?
I didn't see any opposition in person, maybe because this was all last minute. And there was pretty muted reaction from critics of the removal. One Republican state senator did write the city to warn that it would be overstepping the law if they decided to destroy the statues, which is one option they were considering.
And just quickly, it's worth noting that there remains a Robert E. Lee statue in Richmond, not that far away.
And that's also tied up in a legal battle. We're expecting a ruling any day now, any week now.
Ben Pavier is a reporter for member station VPM in Richmond, Virginia. Thank you, Ben.
Happy to do it.
Well, Charlottesville is not the only place with an empty pedestal where a controversial statue once stood. Protesters toppled one outside the Tennessee state capitol in Nashville last summer. But more than a year later, Paige Flager of member station WPLN reports there's still no plan for what to do with that fallen statue or what might replace it.
A statue of a 9-foot-tall mustachioed man is covered up and lying on the ground of a loading dock in downtown Nashville.
Looks like he's a little banged up.
Yes, he is. He has a piece missing in his head.
Oh.
Here. So yeah, there's certainly some damage on the right arm.
John Hull is with Tennessee's Department of General Services. The statue of Edward Carmack, an editor and politician, has been in the loading dock of the Polk office building for a year now, and it's unclear when or where he might move.
You know, it could take 6 to 9 months to actually get the statue repaired. So obviously it is here. We've not sent it out to do that at this point.
Carmack's statue was first removed decades ago for the construction of the tunnel under the state capitol. And even then, people argued against his reinstatement. Now, history repeats itself. That's because in life, in death, and in memorial, Edward Carmack was not very popular.
He's always been somewhat of a controversial figure, even when the statue was being put up.
Annabeth Hayes is a curator with the Tennessee State Museum. She says Carmack was memorialized for being a staunch prohibitionist and getting killed over it. But what he might be most known for are his racist editorials and his feud with journalist and civil rights icon Ida B. Wells. In 1892, Wells wrote about the lynching of 3 black businessmen in Memphis, elevating the story to a national level. And Carmack called for his paper's readers to retaliate against her for it.
He essentially cites a mob in his own newspaper against Ida B. Wells and runs her out of town.
That history is the likely reason that several unknown protesters pulled Carmack from his prominent position at the Capitol at the start of the racial justice protests last year.
It's a heavy statue. It would take at least 15 people to push that thing over.
Shortly after the statue came down, Angel Stansberry and other protesters staged a 62-day occupation of the plaza by the Capitol. They protested against racism and police brutality and demanded Confederate statues be taken down. Many of the protesters were arrested, including Stansberry. While the Carmack statue is gone, a plaque remains. It doesn't mention his opinions on lynching or his feud with Ida B. Wells.
Since she was such a victim of his hate, we just think that it's rightful and just that she replace him here at the People's Plaza.
Stansberry says Carmack's statue and Andrew Jackson's and the bust of KKK Grand Wizard Nathan Bedford Forrest say a lot about who the state memorializes. Monuments like these have not aged well, she says. Even David Hawk, the person who has the best shot at picking the statue to replace Carmack, isn't sure we should be memorializing anybody.
I've never been a particular big fan of statues and monuments in the first place, but I think there are individuals that do rise to that level. And I think that David Crockett is one of those.
Hawk is a Republican state representative, and despite his reservations about monuments, he's leading an effort to commission a statue of Tennessee soldier Davy Crockett. It isn't clear yet where the statue would go. He says protesters helped circumvent the lengthy and arduous legal process to take statues down in Tennessee by bringing Carmack down themselves.
It became somewhat opportunistic that as we've been working on the Davy Crockett statue for the better part of a decade, that now the location where we had hoped to put Crockett all along is vacant.
But Crockett himself is not without controversy. While he was a famous frontiersman, he also participated in a massacre of Native Americans in Alabama, showing that it can be dangerous to try and put anyone on a pedestal. For Here and Now, I'm Paige Flager.
Good question.
That's a really good question.
It's a great question.
This is free therapy.
Thank you for asking me that.
God, that's such a good question.
That's an interesting question.
But what Fresh Air interviews are really about are the interesting answers. Listen and subscribe to Fresh Air from WHYY and NPR.
As many states emerge from the worst of the COVID-19 pandemic, now might be a good time to take stock of your financial future. Certified financial planner Jill Schlesinger has some tips for us. She's CBS News business analyst and also host of Jill on Money. Jill, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. So we, of course, acknowledge that the pandemic is not over, especially in states with low vaccination rates. But what is your top line advice for how to plan as things do start to look much better in much of the country?
You know, I understand that everybody has this pent-up demand, this urge to do something. But before action takes place, I just hope that people can take a moment and say, let's be mindful about this. And I liken this to, I'll use myself as an example. It used to be in the old days, but when I would sit at a bar and wait for my party to arrive, there'd be a pile of nuts, and I would just inhale them, not thinking about what I was doing. And I would say, that's mindless eating. And, you know, I think we do that sometimes with spending. And so I want you to be mindful because a lot of folks are lucky. They got through the pandemic pretty well and maybe they've got some money. But before you do anything, let's think about it. Let's see how it's going to impact your overall financial goals.
Right. There is an opportunity here. A lot of people were able to save money during the pandemic. Of course, many lost their job as well. But if you did keep your job and you spent less on things like vacations or going out, what should you be doing with those savings?
I always like to talk about something called the big three. And the big three for me is to have an emergency reserve fund with at least 6 to 12 months of your living expenses. And it should be in a boring place, a bank account, a money market, a short-term CD. And if you've got that, then you also want to be looking at paying down consumer debt. Credit card debt. Maybe it's an auto loan. Even if it's a few percentage points, it's probably more than it's costing you more than you're earning in that safe money account. And try to maximize your retirement plan contributions to the best of your ability. Now, surely most people don't have enough money to put $19,000, $19,500 into a employer plan or even $6,000, but do the best you can. And if you can get those three parts of your life under control, you are going to feel so much more secure as you move forward.
On the issue of debt, the federal government paused things like interest on student loans during the crisis. What should we be thinking about on sort of the example of like whether or not to start, you know, picking up those debt payments again?
You know, I always say when you think about debt, you just want to kind of create your master spreadsheet. And maybe I'm now showing my age by saying the word spreadsheet. But you want to just take a list of outstanding debt and you list it in terms of highest interest rate debt at the top, followed by your other loans. And you go in descending order. And so you want to attack the highest interest loan first. Once you whittle it down, you shift money towards towards the next highest one. You know, it's much easier to manage these processes right now because you can automate so much of it. So make sure you automate things so you don't miss a payment. There's no penalties. There's no fees. And really do pay attention because these deadlines are coming up very quickly. Within 90 days, all these programs are basically going back to where we were, you know, year and a half ago.
And just very briefly, 30 seconds here. I know this is an opportunity to think about your wills, healthcare proxies, that sort of thing coming out of the pandemic.
Yeah, I mean, I just don't know if we have a better lesson than a pandemic that anything can happen. And besides thinking about how you're going to transfer wealth, your wishes being met is the most important thing. That has nothing to do with your net worth. So please have these conversations, create the documents.
Jill Schlesinger, CBS News business analyst. Thanks so much.
Great to be with you.
Abbas Karimi was born without arms, and for many years, he says he wondered how he could ever be something. Then he found swimming. And in 2017, at the World Para Swimming Championships in Mexico City, he made history in the men's 50-meter butterfly as the first refugee athlete to reach the podium there.
And it looks like it is silver to Karimi, the independent participant there, a 42.35. What a swim from him. And Zapatakis.
Abbas Karimi was born in Afghanistan. At age 16, he and his family fled the war there, living in refugee camps before making it to the U.S. The 24-year-old now lives in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, and next month he will have the honor of competing for the first time at the Paralympic Games taking place in Tokyo. He will do so as a member of the Paralympic refugee team. Abbas Karimi joins us now. Welcome to Here and Now, and congratulations.
Thank you so much, and thank you for inviting me.
And how are you feeling ahead of the Tokyo Games? Are you ready?
Yeah, you know, I've been training my whole life for this, you know, to be able to reach that level and compete at the Paralympic Games, you know. So, you know, my dream came true, and of course, I'm a little bit nervous, but, you know, I have a lot of excitement, and I'm ready.
This past year has been difficult for many people, no matter where they live, because of the pandemic. It's impacted how many athletes train and travel, to be sure. I'm wondering how it has impacted you.
Well, when the COVID started, the pandemic, you know, I couldn't swim for 4 months, and that was the biggest challenge. But at the same time, I was doing dry land, and even the gym was not open back then. And, you know, I was just running and doing some other workouts without weight and without water to just keep myself in shape. You know, I did what I could control, and that was it, you know.
It's already been announced that there will be no fans in the stands at the Tokyo Olympics. Those start in just a couple of weeks. The Paralympics will take place 2 weeks after the closing ceremonies of the Olympics, and we still don't know if fans will be allowed in the stands for your competition. Is that something you're thinking about, what it might be like swimming in empty arenas?
Well, you know, this year I went to two big meets, and there was no fans, without fans. Being there and cheering for us. So for me, it's become like a normal, you know. It doesn't matter for me.
I think we need to hear something about your life. You have overcome so much. We've already said you lived as a refugee. You left your home country of Afghanistan when you were 16 years old to go first to Iran. Tell me about that.
You know, me and my oldest brother, you know, he was willing to help me. You know, he got a passport for me and everything got fixed. And he, you know, we flew to Iran together. And after a week, I went to, you know, Turkey, and walking one mountain to another mountain. And finally, somehow I got to Turkey. So.
You got to Turkey. And let's be clear, you're not a world-class swimmer. Who's making this journey, right? You hadn't even really started swimming yet.
Yeah, I had to start from zero, and I had to find a coach, a team, and everything. So I was nobody.
And you found a pool and a place where you could swim in a refugee camp?
Yes, and I've been in four different camps, different cities in 4 years in Turkey. And every city that I was, I had to find a new coach or a new team. You know, every city that they moved me to one to another city, one camp to another camp. Yeah.
I'm speaking with Abbas Karimi, a swimmer who will be on the Paralympic refugee team next month in Tokyo. And again, Abbas, you are a person who was born without arms. You swim the butterfly event. Tell me about your swimming motion. How do you propel yourself through the water?
You know, butterfly is one of the hardest stroke in the swimming events. And the first time, did my first race in Afghanistan, I was doing breaststroke and backstroke only. And, you know, it took me a lot of years to work on my dolphin kick and then start doing butterfly without arms, and which was not easy. It took me many, many years, a lot of hard work. And, you know, before a race, we do warm-up. Then I'm ready to, you know, race for 50-meter butterfly, and that's how I prepare myself.
And you said it's a dolphin kick you do. Do you literally, using your legs and your torso, do you propel yourself up out of the water as you swim?
Well, when we jump, you know, we go like 15 meter underwater. That's how we allow to win. Underwater, we do dolphin kick, and mostly it's using your core and then your legs. And it's the whole movement, the whole body has to move, but it's mostly its core. You know, the swimmers without arms, they breathe from their side.
Okay. I'm thinking how swimmers with arms, when they're doing the butterfly, literally, it's like they're leaping out of the water with each stroke. And I'm trying to compare that to what your movement looks like.
They took a lot of breath, you know, people with, you know, the regular swimmers with arms and legs, when they do butterfly, they after each dolphin kick, they breathe. But we don't breathe after every kick. We do like four or five dolphin kick, and then we start breathing. And in 50-meter butterfly, most of these swimmers, and including me, we breathe three times or four times, and that's it. We don't breathe no more than that, because the more we breathe, it slows us down. So we have to keep going. We have to have a very strong lung, very strong long breath, so we can handle it, you know. Without the breathing more, we can finish it as soon as possible and hit the wall with our head to touch the wall, you know, to get the first place.
So let's get back to Tokyo, looking ahead. You go to Tokyo not representing a country. You are part of a team of six athletes. All are refugees that represent more than 80 million displaced people around the world, including 12 million who are living with a disability. Most teams have geography, a homeland in common. You all share something else, which is the fact that you have all had to flee your country. What is that like, being part of this group of very elite athletes with a story that goes well beyond the athletic competition?
You know, it makes a lot of sense that I be part of the refugee Paralympic team, because, you know, I'm a refugee and I've been a refugee for 9 years, and what I've been through and what 80 million displaced people have been through, or millions of refugees, no matter what we've been through, and we all went to do, you know, do something positive, and sport, you know, can, you know, build friendships, and it can create friendships, and we can create peace through sport, and it means a lot. And that's the goal, is, you know, to, you know, make the world a better place, you know, for all our, you know, for the whole people in around the world. And for me especially, representing 80 million displaced people is a big honor, and I'll do my best to be a good representative.
You're very much aware, I'm sure, that young girls, young boys around the world who may have a disability will be watching you very closely.
I know, but yeah, you know, for me, the thing is that the only thing that I can tell them is, you know, it's okay if you're born different, you know. No one is the same in this world, and everyone is different, but we all have to accept ourselves and accept each other the way we are and move on with the life. And I hope I'll be a good representative for, you know, for all the people who has disability and make their world better place and, you know, show and prove the world that it's okay that we don't have some part of our body and we have some disability. But at the end, you know, it's our brain, our heart, you know, as long as they're okay and they're working, you know, we're all the same.
That's Abbas Karimi, a swimmer and member of the refugee Paralympic team heading to Tokyo. Abbas, thank you so much, and we wish you good luck.
Thank you so much.
The beloved video game Donkey Kong turns 40 this month. First released in Japan by Nintendo, the game became a staple of the golden age of arcades in the 1980s. It also fueled a decades-long fight over who exactly was the first player to score a million points. Here and Now's Alexander Turk has our story.
Playing the game is simple. You get to the top of a tower, you dodge barrels and fireballs, and you save Pauline from the clutches of the great gorilla Donkey Kong. In shops across the US, gamers would crowd around the machines with pockets of quarters, waiting for their turn to beat the high score. That golden age is long past, but the competitive Donkey Kong scene still thrives today.
Hello, my name's Steve Wiebe.
In Redmond High School, just east of Seattle, Washington, Steve Wiebe teaches math. Most there know him as Mr. Wiebe, but Kong fanatics know him as a legend.
I'm the first person to achieve a million points on Donkey Kong.
Wiebe first played the game in college in the early 90s.
My friend had a fraternity brother that had his own Donkey Kong machine. I thought, how cool is that? So I went out and bought my own.
He put the machine in his fraternity and started beating his friend's records until one day in 1991, he hit level 22.
I took the game home that summer, and I got to this screen that I couldn't get by. I just died within about 7 or so seconds. It was a barrel screen on level 22. I don't know what's going on. Is my machine got a bug?
He was also trying to reach a personal goal of a million points, something to his knowledge no one had ever done.
At that point, I was like, okay, I guess I'm not going to be able to get a million. I think my score was in the 960,000s. So I just sold my machine at that point. This was like in 91.
A couple years after he sold the machine, Wiebe discovered that the mysterious screen at level 22 was what's called a kill screen. It wasn't a bug. He had reached the end of the game. Then Wiebe looked up the current world record. It was set in 1982 by a legendary arcade gamer, a restaurateur named Billy Mitchell, who had been playing the game for years. Here he is in the documentary King of Kong.
It's actually carved a part of my personality that benefits me every day. I mean, a burning passion never to settle for what I have. In my business, in my family, that's what competitive gaming has done for me.
During that summer in 1991, when Wiebe hit the kill screen, he had beaten Mitchell's long-standing score without even realizing it. So he decided to start trying for a million points again.
I know I can get the record, so I had to go buy a machine again.
And the race to a million points was on. Both Wiebe and Mitchell trained for half a decade, perfecting their strategies, until in 2004, officials at Twin Galaxies, that tracks arcade score records, got a new VHS tape from Wiebe, and there, on the screen, Wiebe hits the first ever score of 1 million points in Donkey Kong. But the victory would be short-lived, exactly how the game itself plays out.
And when you reach the top, you save the girl momentarily, and then Donkey Kong whisks her away up the ladder again, and then you do it all over again.
Wiebe was accused of playing with an unofficial circuit board. Wiebe denies it gave him an advantage, but nonetheless, Twin Galaxies vacated his million score. So, the title was back up for grabs. In 2005, Wiebe decided to go for the million-point record in person at a tournament in New Hampshire. Brian Q, another gamer, was at the event, covered in the King of Kong documentary.
This is, he's going to have to play it perfectly. He's at the hardest part of Donkey Kong, and, it's not going to get any easier.
But after 2.5 hours, Wiebe hit the kill screen.
The kill screen kicked in.
And I get 985,000. I didn't break the million live that I had done on tape, but I thought it was close enough that they could see my gameplay was valid and I could achieve a million.
A million was in his grasp until a tape arrived at the arcade in New Hampshire from Weeby's rival, Billy Mitchell, showing that he hit the million record. Twin Galaxies declared Mitchell the Donkey Kong record holder, and the race to a million was over. Weeby had lost. For a few years after that New Hampshire day, Weeby and Mitchell continued to fight for new high scores, but then new players joined the game and beat those records. Here's Weeby.
I couldn't sustain what I was doing forever, and at some point I was thinking, it can't just be me and Billy that can do this.
So Weeby and Mitchell faded to the background until 2018 and an announcement from Twin Galaxies accusing Mitchell of faking the tape that he sent to New Hampshire, among others, using unofficial hardware. Mitchell denies that, and the Guinness Book of World Records has since reinstated his records. But nonetheless, Twin Galaxies dethroned Mitchell. And for Steve Weeby, almost as a footnote, Twin Galaxies declared this math teacher from Redmond, Washington, the first player to ever break a million points in Donkey Kong.
So I don't see myself getting the world record ever again, but it was worth it, I think, to accomplish what I did.
The arcade game Donkey Kong turns 40 this month. For Here and Now, I'm Alexander Turk.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Don Gagne. It's Here and Now.